This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
In September of 1817, the sun rose over Amelia Island, located in the northeast corner of the Florida Peninsula. From the outside looking in, it was a tropical paradise, a tiny settlement surrounded by peaceful waves and palm trees. Within the makeshift huts, however, the atmosphere was entirely different. The island was populated by pirates and American sailors, all itching to charge the Florida mainland and kick out the Spanish armies. But their commander, a Scottish soldier with a formidable reputation, seemed to have no plans on moving anytime soon. Instead of preparing for battle, Gregor MacGregor spent his days lounging around and dreaming of power and fame. When they first arrived, he had established a brand new government for the island, positioning himself as the leader. He even paid his soldiers in Amelia dollars, a new currency he'd created. But while the Scotsman idled, the Spanish forces were amassing on the mainland, directly opposite Amelia Island. They had come to take the land back. The soldiers prepared themselves to fight. Now was the time to finally accomplish their mission. But as the troops readied their arms, Gregor MacGregor readied his luggage. He announced to his men that he was leaving, blaming his allies in the United States for their precarious situation. Then, without another word, he sailed away, leaving the army to fend for themselves. Welcome to Con Artists, a Parcast original. I'm Alastair Murden. Every week, we peel back the layers of history's greatest deceptions and tell the stories of the hustlers, swindlers, and fraudsters that orchestrated them. I'll dive into their psychology, break down their tricks, and explain why anyone might fall for a con. You can find episodes of Con Artists and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Con Artists for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Con Artists in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. This week, we're discussing Gregor MacGregor, a Scottish con artist who started as a military man in the British Army. We'll learn what led him to join the rebel cause in South America and see how his desperation caused him to pull off his first unintentional scam. Next week, we'll learn about Gregor MacGregor's most famous con, the Poyez scheme. We'll see how he came up with the idea, why it became so popular, and what happened to Gregor and his victims. Gregor MacGregor is one of history's earliest known con artists, and also one of the most ambitious. After a career in the British Army, Gregor sought fame and fortune overseas in the 1800s, hoping to make a name for himself in the Venezuelan War of Independence. But his aspirations were far greater than his abilities, and a series of military failures drove him back to the UK. In London, Gregor hatched the Poyez scheme. Much like the disastrous contemporary Fire Festival, Gregor enchanted his marks with tales of a tropical paradise. In this case, a new country. He convinced rich bankers to invest in its government and allowed adventurous men and women to move to the settlement, which was no more than an undeveloped, dangerous territory in South America. Gregor was never sentenced for his crimes, and spent the rest of his life in Venezuela where he died at the age of 58. For much of his life, Gregor MacGregor exaggerated the circumstances of his childhood and the importance of his family. He gave the MacGregor clan more legitimacy by claiming they were related to distant dukes and barons. He alleged that his family was based in Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland. In reality, Gregor was born in Stirlingshire, a small area in the Scottish Highlands, in 1786. His father, Daniel MacGregor, was an East India Company sea captain, whose adventures likely inspired the young Gregor in his future travels. Sadly, Gregor had very little time with his father. Daniel died in 1794 when Gregor was just 7 years old. Gregor and his two sisters were raised by their mother Anne, with the occasional help of other members of the clan. Contrary to the aristocratic blood and wealth that Gregor would later claim, the MacGregors were far from noble. In fact, the MacGregor surname had been officially abolished in England from 1601 to 1661 and 1693 to 1784, after a bitterly violent conflict with another Scottish family. As a result, many MacGregors in Scotland and the UK changed their last names to avoid any association with the Forsaken clan. But the surname still had some legitimacy. Gregor's great-great-uncle, Rob Roy, was a key revolutionary in the Jacobite Rebellion, an internal British conflict over the rightful heir to the throne. Roy later became the subject of a popular novel written by author and poet Sir Walter Scott, restoring honour to the MacGregor name. After Rob Roy's death, Gregor's paternal grandfather secured his own reputation as a respected military man, famously known as Gregor the Beautiful throughout Scotland. But despite these connections, Gregor himself grew up in relative obscurity. Little is known of his childhood other than the fact that he received a good education. He entered the school system when he was just 5 years old and claimed to have begun studies at the University of Edinburgh at 15. This was not an uncommon age to attend college at the time, but shortly after his 16th birthday, Gregor abandoned his higher education for a more lucrative career, the military. In April of 1803, 16-year-old Gregor enrolled in the Scottish Army as an ensign, or a junior officer, thanks to a commission purchased by his mother for what would be just under $60,000 today. At the time, the military was seen as an opportunity for advancement, and families who could afford it often paid to secure high-ranking positions for their sons. Gregor's family, however, wasn't particularly wealthy. So as soon as he assumed his role as a junior officer, he resolved not to squander his chance. He was determined to make a name for himself and his family. Gregor's first assignment coincided with the beginning of the Napoleonic Wars, and as a result, he saw action right away. During the course of this conflict, he quickly rose through the ranks of the infantry. By February of 1804, less than a year after he joined the army, Gregor was promoted to lieutenant, a prestigious position that usually took 3 years to earn. During these glory months, he also met his future wife, Maria Bowater. Maria was the daughter of a late Royal Navy admiral and related to two retired generals. But not only was Maria well connected, she also had a large dowry. All of these very advantageous qualities captured Gregor's undivided attention, and in June of 1805, the young couple was married. 18-year-old Gregor and Maria moved into Maria's aunt's house in London and embarked on a new life together in a new city. Gregor had taken a break from the army after the wedding, but soon, marital bliss proved stifling, and Gregor was itching to relive his glory days. After a few months, he re-enlisted in the army and was immediately promoted to captain. Normally, it would have taken Gregor 7 years to earn the ranking on his own, but he didn't have that kind of patience. Instead, he had something better: a wealthy wife. And by Scottish law, Maria's money was now his. So with his newfound wealth, Gregor simply bought the title for what would amount to nearly $100,000 today. This impatient ambition became a defining factor in Gregor's life and drove his future cons. But it may also reveal a lot about his underlying character. In 2016, a study conducted by Western Sydney University and Queensland University of Technology analyzed individuals who cut corners to accomplish a task. Researchers discovered that people who took shortcuts, like Gregor, were more likely to be less conscientious and less honest. They ranked higher in psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism than their fellow peers. These three traits are also disproportionately found in con artists. But young Gregor was only dipping his toe into the territory of scams, grifts, and fraudulent schemes. For now, he was content with buying his way into getting what he wanted, rather than cheating. After 18-year-old Gregor was promoted to captain, his regiment moved to Gibraltar, an overseas British territory near Spain. The squad settled there for 4 years, from 1805 to 1809. From the outside looking in, Gregor's life seemed to be falling into place. He had a happy marriage, plenty of money, and an enviable status in the army. Gregor's success wasn't altogether surprising. He was witty, charming when he wanted to be, and a sharp dresser whose fashion sense exuded wealth and status. But he also had a strong personality that led him to frequently butt heads with colleagues in the army. And in his first 4 years as captain, he made many enemies within his own troop. Because of his meteoric rise through the military, Gregor had little leadership experience. He was known for selfish behavior, not befit a captain, and made poor decisions based on his own vanity and obsession with rank. For instance, Gregor ordered every soldier under his command to wear their full dress uniform at all times, regardless of the occasion. It was a superficial and impractical requirement that made him highly unpopular with his own troop. In the summer of 1809, Gregor's 57th Regiment was sent to Portugal, and his problems in the military only escalated. Eventually, an argument with one of his superiors finally forced the military to take action. Though the nature of the conflict is unknown, that October, 22-year-old Gregor was transferred to the 8th Line Battalion in the Portuguese Army, a less prestigious division. It was a mere slap on the wrist as a courtesy to Gregor's high ranking. And to soften the blow, his superiors even promoted him to major. But even still, Gregor's ego was bruised. Less than a year later, in May of 1810, he decided he'd had his fill of army life and officially resigned. After handing in his notice, the military returned all of the money he'd paid towards his promotions, an amount totaling nearly $140,000 today. And with that, Gregor was officially discharged from the military with honors. As Gregor left army life behind, he most likely felt an abject failure. He'd come from a line of Scottish military men and married into a highly decorated family. His career in the army was no doubt an enormous disappointment. But nonetheless, Gregor's ambition drove him forward. With his reimbursed commission money in hand and a whole lot of charisma, he set his sights on reinventing himself entirely. After leaving the army and his post in Portugal, 23-year-old Gregor and his wife, Maria, moved back to Scotland, to Edinburgh. There, Gregor started calling himself Colonel, a higher rank than he was ever awarded, and fashioned himself as a member of Scottish high society. He rented an expensive carriage and dressed in the most stylish clothing, perfectly tailored waistcoats and fine top hats. But despite his efforts, Gregor never felt accepted by the creme de la creme of Edinburgh. Perhaps his cursed surname left a bad taste in the mouth of his fellow Scots. But either way, Gregor was far from discouraged. He relocated his small family to London, where, once again, he reinvented himself. This time, he went by Sir Gregor MacGregor and told everyone he met that he was the new chieftain of the MacGregor clan. It was a bold lie, but in England, no one was the wiser. And as he rubbed elbows with London's wealthy elite, he would often refer to his many noble relatives, old barons, dukes, and earls from days past. None of these relatives actually existed, of course, but Gregor believed that just the mention of old money and power would help him break into these highfalutin social circles. And it worked. Until tragedy struck. In December 1811, Gregor's wife, Maria, died. The circumstances of her death are unclear, but it was a huge blow to Gregor. Maria was his wife, of course, but she was also his main source of income and linked to London's wealthy social circles, his key to high society and his meal ticket. But Gregor was as tenacious as he was ambitious, and soon his quest for fame and fortune would take him to the other side of the world. Coming up next, Gregor looks for opportunity in the Venezuelan rebellion. Now, back to the story. In 1811, the life of prestige that 25-year-old Gregor MacGregor had so carefully built was crumbling. After his fall from grace in the military, Gregor set his sights on London, where he reinvented himself into a wealthy aristocrat. But when his young wife Maria died, his best-laid plans were obliterated. Maria's wealth had been Gregor's entry into London's high society and his main source of income. He'd grown accustomed to a certain standard of living during his marriage. With his wife's money, he could afford stylish clothing, expensive housing, and every level of comfort. On his own, however, he could no longer maintain the same sumptuous lifestyle, and finding a new source of income was difficult. Gregor couldn't return to the British Army after his somewhat disgraceful exit, and he wasn't able to marry another wealthy heiress without angering London society. But as he languished in the UK, watching his money dwindle, Gregor had an unconventional idea. While Gregor was ingratiated in London's aristocratic circles, a common topic of conversation was Latin America's uprisings against the Spanish crown, specifically Venezuela's. At the time, Venezuela was a hotbed for revolution. 7 of its 10 major districts rebelled against the Spanish in 1811, kicking off the Venezuelan War of Independence. But Gregor's interest went beyond international politics. Shortly before the war broke out, he had heard rumors about General Francisco de Miranda, one of the revolution's famous leaders. Miranda had recently visited London, where he'd become the talk of the town. Everyone, it seemed, admired and respected the general, and the city's elite practically fought one another to host him at their homes or dinner parties. Gregor watched on enviously as Miranda was praised for his bravery and welcomed with open arms into the very circles Gregor longed to join. Miranda didn't stay in London long, but his short visit made an invaluable impression on Gregor. He was inspired. As the Scotsman faced the prospect of losing his wealth and his status in London, his thoughts returned to the general. Miranda was a military man, like Gregor. but his exploits in Venezuela made him a hero in the eyes of British high society. Gregor realized that perhaps if he fought in the Venezuelan rebellion, he too would be admired and praised. Of course, Gregor had no interest in the cause itself, and had never been to South America. But he figured that an army was an army, no matter where in the world it was. How different could it be? So in early 1812, 26-year-old Gregor sold the Scottish estate he'd inherited from his father and set sail for the New World. Gregor's voyage to Venezuela took 4 long, arduous months with a short stop in Kingston. He spent most of the time in his cabin, dreaming of the new life he would build for himself and all the ways in which South America would bring him glory. But when he finally stepped off the ship in the capital city of Caracas in April 1812, he was immediately disappointed. Caracas had been devastated by an earthquake, and the disaster had set the rebellion back. By the time Gregor arrived, large areas of the country had been reclaimed by the Spanish. But Gregor was far from deterred. He had come to fight for Venezuela, after all, and it seemed they needed him more than ever. Soon, he found General Miranda himself and offered his services. Gregor boasted to Miranda about his past conquests, playing up his accomplishments in the British military. Miranda took the bait and immediately promoted Gregor to colonel. Things were going even better than he dreamed. Gregor was immediately popular. As a Scotsman, he was considered almost exotic, and his European military training invaluable. In no time, he was a regular fixture in influential social circles, where he quickly found a new wife, Doña Josefa. Josefa was the daughter of a prominent family in Caracas and the cousin of Simón Bolívar, the famed South American revolutionary. The young couple married on June 10, 1812, just a few months after Gregor first arrived. Around the same time, Gregor was promoted yet again to Brigadier General. But even though he was finding success in Venezuela, the revolutionary cause was failing. Just 1 month after Gregor's wedding and promotion, General Miranda was captured. Gregor and the remaining soldiers retreated to the neighboring island of Curaçao. With Miranda imprisoned, Simón Bolívar took over the rebel cause. Wary of their vulnerable position, Bolívar commanded that the army wait on Curaçao until they found the right time to strike. But Gregor grew impatient with Bolívar's tactics. The only way that he would get the fame and recognition he wanted was by being on the front lines of a battle. So Gregor took matters into his own hands. He slipped away from Curaçao and joined a more radical rebel group in New Granada in what is now modern-day Colombia, Venezuela, and Ecuador. There, Gregor once again played up his military prowess and European training to secure a new commission. But the soldiers under his command were less than impressed. They described Gregor as a Don Quixote character. He may have talked a big game, but performed so poorly on the battlefield that he may as well have been fighting windmills. But there wasn't much time to complain about Gregor's leadership skills in the face of a rebellion. The Spanish were advancing, and before long, they had forced Gregor's regiment to Cartagena, a port city on Colombia's western border. By late 1815, the new Granada forces were completely surrounded, and just a few hundred rebel soldiers were left in the city. Gregor was one of 3 commanding officers charged with getting everyone out of Cartagena safely. And somehow, against all odds, they succeeded. It's unclear whether Gregor had a large hand in planning the operation, but when it turned out to be a resounding success, he claimed credit for the victory all the same. And over the next year, 29-year-old Gregor's military campaigns proved enormously successful, mostly because he was single-minded when it came to pursuing a victory. When his soldiers were outnumbered and outgunned, Gregor kept pushing forward, ignoring the odds stacked against them. This mindset was instrumental in keeping the Spanish army from advancing and earned Gregor accolades for his bravery, but also demonstrated a lack of empathetic leadership. According to researcher James Anger, leaders can often be divided into two categories: those who are results-focused and those who show exceptional social skills, such as strong communication or empathy. Individuals who are more results-focused were found to frequently reach their goals at the expense of those that work underneath them. For Gregor, the stakes couldn't have been higher. Running into battle despite being outmanned often meant that he was putting his soldiers' lives in danger. He'd lose dozens of men, if not hundreds, all for the glory of a battlefield victory. And this, understandably, bred contempt among his troops. Despite the fact that Gregor had Simón Bolívar's personal gratitude, he often clashed with his commander in charge and found himself losing control of his men. Just like in Europe, Gregor had failed to gain the respect of his regiment. So he did what he did best and simply moved on. In October 1816, 29-year-old Gregor left New Granada for Margarita Island, just off the coast of Venezuela. There, he found a new commission under General Juan Bautista Arizmendi. Arizmendi's goal was to take Florida from the Spanish, and he put Gregor in charge of the mission. It was right up Gregor's alley. Florida could be a huge asset for South America. And as the sole commander of the operation, he would naturally receive all of the accolades. To prepare for the operation, Gregor, his wife, and a group of top-ranking officials sailed to the United States in March of 1817. They knew that without American support, it would be nearly impossible to take Florida back from the Spanish. So Gregor turned on the charm. He promised his potential investors huge returns on their donations or a piece of property in Florida. It was never clear whether or not he had the authority to fulfill these promises, but in 3 months, he managed to raise what would amount to nearly $3.5 million today. Gregor also recruited several hundred American men to help fight for the cause. And on June 29th, 1817, Gregor and 80 soldiers sailed to Amelia Island off the coast of the Florida Peninsula, the perfect location to launch their attack. But Gregor didn't wait to conquer Florida before staking his claim. As soon as they dropped anchor, Gregor declared Amelia Island as the capital of the new Republic of the Floridas. He even created a new flag for the state and started paying his soldiers in an invented currency that he called Amelia bills. But his men were less than pleased. They didn't want to use the phony currency. They wanted to loot the island. But Gregor had forbidden it. And if his soldiers happened to get their hands on any treasure that the island's resident pirates left behind, he taxed them for the valuables. But perhaps what irritated them the most was the fact that Gregor refused to mount his attack. The soldiers sat on Amelia Island, itching to go to battle, but Gregor insisted they lay low and wait for the rest of his recruits. He explained that without their full numbers, it would be impossible to take Florida. So they waited. As the weeks dragged into months, their supplies inevitably dwindled. The Amelia bills were spent too quickly, and soon Gregor was forced to stop paying the soldiers altogether. But in September of 1817, when the Spanish forces started assembling to attack the island, Gregor's men had had enough. The Spanish army gathered slowly, giving Gregor's men plenty of time to prepare. And yet, Gregor did nothing. They were sitting ducks. Going against orders, his men rushed to arm themselves against the coming attack. But Gregor simply gave up. He knew he lacked the skills to defeat the Spanish with such few men, so he pushed the blame on the Americans. He announced that his so-called supporters had cheated him and sabotaged their cause. Then, with that, Gregor boarded his ship, taking his high-ranking officers with him. They set sail towards the Bahamas and left their men to fight off the Spanish on their own. Amelia Island was Gregor MacGregor's first, albeit unintentional, financial con. His American investors never got their money back, and the Spanish were easily able to overcome his remaining men on the island. But the experience taught Gregor some valuable lessons. Another man might have vowed to brush up on his military tactics, but Gregor focused on a new skill. After Amelia Island, he realized just how easy it was for him to convince people to follow his lead with the right combination of words and empty promises. And as he contemplated leaving the army yet again, Gregor started to wonder how else he might put those abilities to good use. Coming up next, Gregor figures out how to turn a profit in the military. Now, back to the story. In 1817, 30-year-old Gregor MacGregor completed his first, albeit unintentional, con. After promising investors huge returns and sprawling property in Spanish-owned Florida, Gregor secured thousands of dollars and dozens of men for the Venezuelan rebellion against Spain. But for months, Gregor dragged his feet instead of mobilizing his troops to take over Florida. And when the Spanish finally came to them, Gregor simply fled, abandoning his men to fight the Spanish on their own. As he sailed away from Amelia Island, Gregor believed he was ready to walk away from the military entirely. Instead of returning to Venezuela, he and his second wife, Josefa, set course for the Bahamas. 2 months later, in November 1817, she gave birth to a baby boy. They named him Gregorio. The small family spent months in the Bahamas, enjoying the sunshine as the baby grew older. During that time, Gregor and his family were well provided for by supporters of the Venezuelan rebellion. To them, Gregor was a revolutionary hero, and they had no reason to believe otherwise. Despite all the evidence to the contrary, Gregor only ever spoke of Amelia Island as a total success. And no one, except the men he'd abandoned, knew how much of a disaster the operation actually was. And so, he simply soaked up this special treatment. But after nearly a year in the Bahamas, his ambitions were getting the best of him. He was dreaming about fame and glory once again. In 1818, Gregor got word that the South American rebels were trying to recruit British soldiers for the revolution. It seemed like the perfect opportunity, a way to use his expertise for the cause without actually risking his own neck. He jumped on it. That September, Gregor, Josefa, and their baby boy sailed from the Bahamas to Europe, where a Venezuelan envoy agreed to employ Gregor as a recruiter. They handed him a starting fund of £1,000, about $112,000 today, to bring British troops to South America. Once he had it in hand, Gregor's greed overwhelmed his good intentions. He started spending the money on himself, using it to buy the finest clothing and expensive dinners, creating the luxurious lifestyle he'd always longed for. And before he knew it, all £1,000 had disappeared. Gregor panicked. He hadn't even started his mission yet, and he had zero funds. He was sure that when the envoy found out what he'd done, he'd denounce Gregor to both English high society and his comrades back in South America. But he got lucky. Miraculously, an old friend, Thomas Newt, a financier and a staunch supporter of the rebels, heard Gregor was recruiting troops and offered to fund his cause. His only condition was that the troops be taken to New Granada instead of Venezuela. Gregor couldn't believe his luck. He took the bailout without any arguments. After all, as long as the troops made it to South America, the envoy would be happy, and it made little difference to him. Using Thomas Newt's donation, Gregor enlisted 50 officers and 500 soldiers to the fight. But his recruitment methods were highly suspect. Gregor offered lower commissions for purchase than other troops. This made recruitment easy, but it also meant that his regiment amassed a smaller budget for food and supplies. And to strain the few funds they had left, Gregor also promised any soldier who came on board a huge salary. So, on November 18th, 1818, the motley crew set sail for South America in high spirits. But it wouldn't last. It took Gregor and his soldiers 3 months to reach Ocaya, located in modern-day Haiti. There, they made a stop to stock up on supplies before continuing their journey. But once they landed in the small port town, the soldiers almost rebelled. They had yet to see a penny of the huge salaries Gregor promised, and some were quickly realizing that as a commander, Gregor was entirely incompetent. His second-in-command, Colonel William Ratner, managed to keep the men from revolting, and Gregor promised them their money as soon as they docked in South America. But there was just one problem. They didn't leave port. Gregor stalled on the island for a whole month. Once again, he seemed to actively avoid combat for as long as possible. He enjoyed being the company leader, except when that company had to march into battle. For weeks, the troops languished on Ocaya, waiting for their commander to make a move. Finally, after a month, the soldiers demanded to leave port, and Gregor, realizing he couldn't stall forever, acquiesced. On April 10th, 1819, the troops landed in Portobello, Panama, yet another stop on their way to New Granada. But this one was occupied by Spanish forces. Gregor and his men dropped anchor just off the city shores and rowed towards land, guns at the ready. Colonel William Ratner, Gregor's trusted second-in-command, led the troops from the front. He paused, scrutinizing the horizon for the enemy. Then, on his signal, the British army charged toward the beach. In just a couple of hours, the Spanish forces in Portobello were defeated. Gregor's soldiers celebrated, but no one was louder or more boisterous than Gregor, who credited his military prowess for their success. In the throes of battle, few of the soldiers wondered why they hadn't seen their brave and fearless leader on shore. If they had, they might have realized that Gregor hadn't taken part in the fighting at all. In fact, he had been back on the ship the entire time, waiting for Ratner to give the all clear to come ashore. Then, he'd rowed ashore just in time to claim the victory alongside the men who'd actually done the work. Still celebrating their triumphant battle, Gregor decided to ignore Ratner's advice to keep the troops moving in favor of settling in Portobello. Gregor wanted to relax and enjoy the riches left behind by the Spanish. So, for 3 weeks, he and his soldiers took advantage of everything Portobello had to offer. They slept in comfortable accommodations, ate good food, and drank decadent wine. But in the early morning hours of April 30th, 1819, Gregor's soldiers were sleeping off their alcohol from the night before when the Spanish troops crept through their encampment. As the sun rose, Gregor's soldiers finally awoke to realize they were under attack. By then, it was too late. The Spanish had them cornered. The army looked in vain for their fearless leader, but Gregor was already long gone. As soon as he'd woken to the commotion, he had hopped out of his window and made for the ships docked offshore. The Spanish victory over the British was quick and easy. And while the soldiers he'd recruited were being captured by the enemy, Gregor commanded his remaining men to sail him to safety. Much like on Amelia Island, Gregor gave no thought to the men he'd abandoned. And many of them were killed in Spanish custody, including Gregor's far more competent second hand, William Ratner. Portobello was a disaster from start to finish. But soon enough, Gregor pulled an almost identical stunt in a northern city of New Granada called Rio de la Hacha. Most of the soldiers he led into the city ended up never coming home. Again and again, Gregor made the same mistakes, recruiting troops, stalling them ashore for far too long, and then abandoning them to their deaths just as the enemy was swooping in. But rather than learning from his blunders, Gregor had a tendency to shrug them off, pass the blame to someone else, and do it all again. This habit of shifting the blame may be exactly the reason why Gregor kept falling into the same pitfalls. In a 2014 study observing felony convicts, researchers found that most criminals could be sorted into two categories: those who felt guilty for their actions and those who felt shame. While these may sound similar, there is one key difference between the two. Those who feel guilty blame themselves for their actions, while those who felt shame tried to blame others for their mistakes. Over a period of time, researchers found that criminals who felt shame had a higher chance of committing the same crime than those who felt guilty. This was because the guilty convicts were more likely to correct their own behavior, while the shameful ones never bothered to reflect on how they needed to change. Gregor's actions indicate that he was in the shame category, and this may explain why he kept repeating the same disastrous behavior. But though he never held himself accountable, others certainly did. Word got out after these military disasters, and soon Gregor found himself shunned by comrades and even close friends. Simón Bolívar, who had given him special commendations on more than one occasion, charged Gregor with treason. He put out orders to hang the Scotsman if he ever returned to the South American continent. Gregor was devastated. He tried to blame the failures on anyone but himself, assuring the rebels that he was a victim of circumstance. But it was too late. Past the bravado and the false charm, everyone could see Gregor for the fraud he truly was. Fearing for his life, Gregor and his wife disappeared for several months. In his mind, the military had become far more trouble than it was worth. He could now see that it wouldn't get him to where he wanted to go. But his recent experiences did give him some new ideas. Gregor learned that the British were especially susceptible to the idea of adventuring to exotic South America. This meant that there was money to be made in sending Europeans overseas. What happened to them after wasn't his concern. But perhaps the most valuable lesson of all was that he realized that he didn't need to be a decorated army man to gain the recognition he desired. All he had to do was act the part long enough to earn people's confidence. With this in mind, Gregor set about putting together something truly brazen. He invented an entirely new country. Thanks for listening to Con Artists. We'll be back next week with part two of Gregor MacGregor's story. We'll learn how he put together his most audacious con yet, and, in the process, created a fictitious country. We'll also see how he convinced people to move to this undiscovered territory and what happened once he was outed as a fraud. For more information on Gregor MacGregor, amongst the many sources we used, we found the book The Land That Never Was by David Sinclair extremely helpful to our research. You can find all episodes of Con Artists and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Con Artists, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Con Artists on Spotify, just open the app and type Con Artists in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Con Artists was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Aaron Larson. This episode of Con Artists was written by Liz Dorovitsyn, with writing assistance by Abigail Cannon. I'm Alastair Murden.